You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms
and conditions. 18 plus. We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from The Weather Channel, television's most trusted source for severe weather coverage. Go beyond maps and apps and dive into the science and stories behind the storm, because understanding our atmosphere is the best way to prepare for severe weather. Every season, every storm, every time you watch, trust The Weather Channel. And now, enjoy the show. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. From the time of the Greeks and the Persians clashing in the Mediterranean, sea power has determined world power. To an extent that is often underappreciated, it still does. No one understands this better than Admiral James Stavridis. Admiral Stavridis is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy who spent over 35 years on active service in the Navy. He commanded destroyers and a carrier strike group in combat and served for 7 years as a four-star admiral. He was the first naval officer to serve as commander of U.S. Southern Command, commander of U.S. European Command, and NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Since retiring from military service, he now serves as dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, but there's no doubt that his heart is still on the ocean. Stavridis is a man who's sailed the seven seas and can describe the weather, the sights, sounds, and smells of every body of water from the Arctic to the Mediterranean. He fondly tells stories of his first trip across the equator and the traditional hazings that ensue. He tells the history of all the battles fought on all the oceans of the earth and why those waters were strategically important then and now. Listening to him talk about his decades in the Navy is enough to make any man take to the high seas and fall in love with the ocean. And in his new book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, Admiral Stavridis takes the reader with him on a tour of the world's oceans from the Admiral's chair, showing us how the geography of the oceans has shaped the destiny of nations, and how naval power has in a real sense made the world we live in today, and will shape the world we live in tomorrow. Today, the Admiral joins me on the podcast to talk about his love of the sea and why naval power is not an antiquated idea, but of vital strategic importance to America's national interests. He'll take us ocean by ocean to discuss the current geopolitical concerns in every region of the world, from China's man-made islands in the South China Sea to Russia's ambitious territorial grab in the Arctic Circle. He discusses the competing interests and lawlessness that could make the Indian Ocean one of the most dangerous hot zones in the 21st century. He warns that Russia's suspicious activity along fiber optic cables in the Atlantic could cut off 95% of the world's communication. And he explains why it's time for the U.S. to stop outsourcing the North Korean nuclear talks to China. He calls for the U.S. to invest in a 350-ship naval buildup. He suggests that it's time for the U.S. to sign something called the Law of the Sea Treaty, and he cautions President Trump to stand firm with our NATO allies. He also shares an important lesson he learned from his captain when he was a young, headstrong ship handler, and he describes how he's seen the results of global warming with his own eyes. Coming up with Admiral James Stavridis in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
James Stavridis is one of the most decorated naval officers of our time, a retired four-star admiral with 35 years of active service in the Navy. Stavridis served as the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO from 2009 to 2013. He's now the Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he's written a fascinating book called Sea Power: The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Admiral Stavridis, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Ben, it's great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Well, I have to say, I really loved this book because you talk about the sea in a way that only an old mariner can. You say that you've spent nearly 11 years total at sea. I can probably count the number of days I've spent not on terra firma on one hand. But you make me long to sail the seven seas just reading this book. You talk about how each one of the seas feels, and the weather and the stories they tell, the conquests and battles that have taken place on them. You seem to have a very romantic view of the ocean.
I do. And I'll tell you how I got there. I grew up in a family that had nothing to do with the ocean. We were, if anything, a camping family, not a go-to-sea family. I had never been on the water when I went off to the U.S. Naval Academy. And I went there because I wanted to be a U.S. Marine. The Naval Academy trains both Marine ground officers as well as seagoing officers. So I went there, and the Naval Academy sends you out to sea after your first year of college. And I went out on a destroyer out of San Diego, and I walked up on the bridge of that ship as the sun was setting, and I was like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. I just saw all that water and all that light, and I just wanted to be at sea. And I think the ocean hits people that way, and when it does, you are a sailor for life.
And one of the most enjoyable aspects of this book is reading about your early years in the Navy and traditions like the hazing when it's your first time crossing the equator or the Arctic Circle. And you talk about this crusty old captain you had when you were a young, cocky ship driver and some advice he gave you after you took the ship into Pearl Harbor and dinged her up a little bit. You want to tell that story?
I was a very young officer trying to handle the ship. Things were just not going very well. I got way ahead of my skill set and tried to drive the ship in a way that I just wasn't ready to do. And he very gracefully came in and sort of sorted it out, put it alongside the pier, and he turned to me and he said, "Stavridis, you know, the mark of a great ship handler is never getting into a situation that requires great ship handling skills." And I thought that was words to live by for us all, whatever our endeavors. In other words, play inside your game. Don't try and swing for the fences. Figure it out. Learn and grow as you go along. That's the kind of captain to have to give me advice like that.
Yeah, and it also sounds like it's advice that could be applied to geopolitics as well.
Indeed. And certainly as you look around the world today and you think about where have nations gotten themselves in trouble, both through history and even today, it's when they try and outreach their capabilities, outreach their history and culture, and they do so in ways that have dramatically tragic endings often. I would say the U.S. misadventure in Iraq would probably qualify in that category, for example.
When most of us look at the globe, we focus on the shape of the seven continents. You say that you see the shapes of the seven seas. Now, many of us in the 21st century, you know, we hear words like sea power and we think back to the Spanish Armada or the British Navy in the 18th and 19th centuries. And the idea of sea power probably almost seems quaint to us. Why is it still important that America remain a maritime power?
Yeah, I'll give you three reasons very quickly. First, again, back to looking at a globe, 70% of the world is covered by water. And by the way, 70% of your body is made out of water. And 70% of the oxygen we breathe comes from photosynthesis at sea. So just the mass and scale of the oceans are crucially important. Secondly, it's trade. 95% of all international trade flows across those oceans. And if any nation had the ability to close those trade routes, it would cripple the economy of any nation so targeted. And then thirdly, the environment. If we do not treat the oceans with sufficient respect, they will lose the ability to produce the oxygen that we need. Now, that's not a this century problem. It's further out in the future. And then finally, it's the geopolitics of a rising China, which will manifest as a maritime power seeking to dominate the South China Sea, the resurgence of Russian sea power. We see it already in the Mediterranean, the North Atlantic, and the Arctic, and the potential rise of India in this century. We have had the oceans. We, the United States, have dominated the oceans since the end of the Cold War. They've been American lakes. There are new sailors coming to sea. We better be ready for that in this century.
And over your 35 years, you have sailed all of the seven seas, and you use that to structure the book. Each sea gets a chapter, beginning with the Pacific, which I think is no accident. Many have called this the Pacific Century, and it is, after all, the largest of all the oceans. Much of the strategic jockeying in the Pacific, as you mentioned a moment ago, is taking place in the South China Sea, where China is building these enormous man-made islands. Why is this particular corner of the Pacific so important? What do they want?
Well, first of all, it's big. It's the size of the Gulf of Mexico. Secondly, the Chinese claim it in its entirety. This would be like the United States simply claiming the Gulf of Mexico. And why that is significant is because underneath that South China Sea are billions of barrels of oil and trillions of cubic square feet of natural gas. It would be an unbelievable energy windfall for China. And thirdly, 80% of all trade in Asia flows through that. Back to our earlier conversation, Ben, about the ability to choke off those sea lanes of communication. China could hold Japan and South Korea at extreme risk by controlling the South China Sea. And what's the long-term Chinese goal? They want to dominate Asia, East Asia. And frankly, they will use the maritime instruments. They're not going to invade other countries with their armies, but they're going to use these maritime instruments and control the South China Sea right at the center of their long-term geopolitical plan.
Is there any actual legitimacy to China's claim to those waters?
No, there's not. I have a PhD in international law with a particular focus on the law of the sea, and I've spent a great deal of time analyzing this. But don't take my word for it. The International Court in The Hague, after an exhaustive review of years of documentation, has ruled the claim unfounded. Each of the other nations around the South China Sea have rejected it. It fails on the practice of nations. There is no treaty to support it. There's no historical claim to support it. And there certainly is no international law to support it. It is a preposterous claim. And the Chinese are trying to buttress it by building these artificial islands, which some have called a Great Wall of Sand, which is merely their attempt to put little chunks of what they claim is Chinese land territory in the middle of this South China Sea and then claim it in its entirety. It is preposterous.
And as a control to some of this, you've been encouraging the president to sign the UN's Law of the Sea Treaty in order to protect trade and create some kind of ground rules going ahead. What exactly would that treaty do?
It would codify the U.S.'s support for the traditional norms of international law, which would reject the claims of the Chinese. The Chinese claims came through this Law of the Sea Treaty process and have been rejected by it. We, the United States, have less legitimacy in that process because we are not signatories to the treaty. By the way, of the 185 countries that have a seacoast, all but three have signed that treaty, the United States being the vast, large one that has held out. And that's a big mistake for our country.
So China and Russia are signatories?
They are, indeed.
Can we realistically expect that countries like China and Russia, which don't seem to have that much respect for territorial borders and waters, would adhere to the treaty?
No, but what we can do is build a wall, and each brick you put in that wall makes your side of the argument stronger. So mm-hmm. when you operate American warships in and around those islands, going right through what the Chinese claim are territorial seas, you put a brick in the wall. You say, we do not recognize your claim. When you place economic sanctions on China for building and crushing these reefs, you put another brick in the wall. When you sign the treaty and you are part of the legitimate process, international process, you put another brick in the wall. Now, whether China and Russia will adhere to that or not, is unclear, but it's better to be inside the tent having the argument than standing on the outside trying to shout through the tent wall.
Yeah, no doubt. Going back to the Pacific, you talk at length about North Korea. From my perspective, help me out here, it seems that we've relied for far too long on China to contain North Korea's nuclear program. And it doesn't strike me that China has been a particularly honest broker in its supposed efforts. Is that an accurate assessment of the situation, or is there something I'm missing here?
No, you're not missing anything. The Chinese have talked the talk, but they have utterly failed to walk the walk. They have not used their enormous economic leverage. They control 95% of the North Korean economy. They could bring the place to its knees in a matter of weeks. Particularly and easily by controlling fuel going in and out. So China has paid lip service to this idea of putting pressure on the North Koreans, but they've simply failed to do so. Why? The reason is because they like a divided Korean peninsula, and what they want is a regime in the north that is controllable by them, but what they don't want is a collapse of that regime, because they feel as though that is what would lead to unification of the peninsula. So China is playing a very delicate role here, trying to put enough pressure on to control Kim Jong-un, but not so much that it implodes the regime and leads to refugees going into China and ultimately to a reunification. The Chinese don't want that because they've watched, for example, what happened in Germany, when East Germany and West Germany combined and created this juggernaut in Central Europe. They don't want that in Asia. They don't want the competition.
Well, now that President Xi Jinping has as much as told President Trump that they haven't been able to deter North Korea, what should our next steps be?
I would say there are three things we ought to do. One is we ought to increase our preparation for combat operations defensively. In other words, we need more THAAD missile systems, more Aegis ships. We need more defensive capability to try and protect the 200,000 American citizens that live and work in Korea, many of them associated with the Department of Defense. So there's a defensive component. Secondly, I think we should increase our cyber and do everything we can to find ways to take apart the North Korean command and control systems, and particularly their nuclear systems, using a combination of cyber and special forces. That's sort of the offensive piece of this. And then thirdly, sometimes the best plan B is to try harder at plan A. And I think plan A, which is get China to get Kim Jong-un under control, is actually a pretty good plan. So I think we do need to continue to put energy into convincing China to play the right set of cards with Kim Jong-un. Now, on the positive side, we need more dialogue. I'm in favor of negotiations. And I think that I could, as an analyst, I could live with freezing the program as opposed to getting rid of the program. I think you could probably construct a negotiated outcome along those lines if China is willing to put the pressure on North Korea to bring him to the table. So there's three things I would sketch out to move forward.
Well, moving over to the Atlantic, you say the zone of competition is the North Atlantic, particularly in the gaps between Greenland, Iceland, and the UK. And in particular, the thing that concerns me is these reports of suspicious activity by the Russians along fiber optic cables at the bottom of the Atlantic. I've brought this up with guests in the past, and they say, well, you know, we have satellites, people talk on cell phones, it's not that big a deal. But it sounds like this is a pretty big concern to you, right?
It's an enormous concern, and I'm surprised that your guests would articulate that view. Anybody who really looks at what flows on these underground cables, and there's only about 250 of them. They carry 95% of all data that moves around the world.
Wow.
Data is the new oil. And frankly, they're vulnerable. I think the reason they're not hit more often or threatened more directly is that everybody relies on them. Mm-hmm. But satellites are not the answer and carry a tiny percentage of global communications. Those fiber optic networks under the oceans are absolutely crucial.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with Admiral James Stavridis in just a minute. If you're interested in my conversation today, you should check out Sea Power, the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, by my guest today, Admiral James Stavridis. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Sea Power by Admiral Stavridis or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews, or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the podcast. And the Indian Ocean is one that gives you a lot of concern. You say what was largely a transit zone is becoming a space of geopolitical criticality, to use your term. As you describe it, it sounds like the Indian Ocean is sort of the Wild West right now. Talk about some of the competing players in the Indian Ocean that could make that region a real problem area.
First of all, when a historian 300 years from now looks back on this century and is writing the story of the 21st century, it will not be, my view, about the rise of China. It will be about the rise of India. The reason the Indian Ocean has been as a transit zone for five centuries is because India has never exercised significant maritime engagement. That is changing. The Indians are building a fleet. They're going to want to operate at sea. And one of the big geopolitical questions of this century is, how does India orient itself? From the perspective of the United States, we would be well served to try and build the strongest possible set of relationships with India for this reason. Secondly, in the Indian Ocean, Iran will be a significant player. Not to the degree India will be, but Iran is a big, robust, militarily oriented nation with significant seacoast, and also they will want to control the entrance to the Arabian slant Persian Gulf. That is the third key area. Let's recall that the Persian Gulf is simply an offshoot of the Indian Ocean. Here we'll see a Sunni-Shia competition that will play itself out over the next several decades, with Iran on one side and Saudi Arabia leading a Sunni bloc on the other. So I think, unfortunately, the Indian Ocean is in for a significant period of competition. I'll close by saying, don't forget about Pakistan, which has a modest seacoast but a pretty good navy. And if India and Pakistan should come to blows, there'll be a significant maritime component of that as well.
And you point out that India is a vibrant democracy, in fact, the largest in the world and a natural ally for the U.S. You say America would be well-served to solidify our relationships with India. Did you see that in Trump's meeting with the Indian President Modi?
I did, and I saw it particularly, frankly, from Mr. Modi, and that was very encouraging. I think Modi understands the natural connectivity between the United States and India because we're democracies, because English is their lingua franca that really their business and government is conducted in. Because they're such a young nation and so vibrant, there's enormous potential connection between India and the United States. And I think this administration gets that. But of course, it has a lot of competing priorities. But I can tell you unquestionably, India gets that. So that's, I think, a very high possible linkage for the United States in this century.
Well, going with the order of the book, we tend to think of the Mediterranean as a place of relative calm, but you say there's a real danger of ISIS invading Europe through the Mediterranean southern border. Talk some more about that.
Yeah, they're doing it already, and it's coming through Libya. One of the really disheartening episodes of the last few years, and certainly at the end of my career, was the attacks in Libya. They were mounted by NATO for good reason. They were requested by the United Nations to protect the people of Libya. But once the operation was concluded and Gaddafi was killed by his own people, I hasten to point out, the NATO, European Union, United States, we all walked away from Libya. That has created a chaotic situation in Libya. The Islamic State and Al-Qaeda are there in significant numbers, and they are finding their way into this slipstream of refugees that are flowing out of Libya into principally Italy, but also Spain, France, and Greece. So there are real worries about the jihadists in that slipstream coming across. And of course, in Italy in particular, the Catholic Church is an enormous potential target for them.
Some people may be surprised to hear that you say that the Arctic Sea may be the most important geostrategic zone of competition in the coming decades due to climate change. For anyone who has doubts, what have you seen with your own eyes as evidence that global warming is taking place in the Arctic?
Yeah, there's just no question. The levels of ice are receding dramatically year after year. And within a decade or so, there'll be year-round sea lanes that will flow through the Arctic. As a result of that, there'll be extremely significant geopolitical competition between Russia on one side of the Arctic and five NATO nations on the other side, the United States, Canada, Norway, Iceland, and Greenland, which is part of Denmark. So we are set up for, no pun intended, another Cold War up where it's really cold. And let's hope we don't get to that point. As I talk about in the book, Sea Power, what we need to rely on is diplomacy, international organizations like the Arctic Council, mature dialogue between states to address the ecological problems, the safety issues, that this is going to be a tourism zone before very long. Search and rescue could be significant. We've got a lot we can do together in a positive way in the Arctic. So I hope it remains as it is today, the only ocean in which a major naval battle has never been fought. Let's hope it stays that way.
Well, Russia is certainly making a big play in the Arctic. What's at stake for them there?
Hydrocarbons, principally. They would like to dominate the region from a energy perspective. Secondly, they'd like to be able to control those shipping lanes and have a say in who moves through them. Thirdly, they have an interest in a number of territories that are there that are disputed, including one with a significant one with Norway. This gets into, back to that Law of the Sea Treaty, it gets into where is Russian territory under the oceans, the continental shelf. What are the dividing lines for it? All of that is it's a big opportunity for Russia, and their economy, of course, is basically a one-trick pony. They're a big gas station, so they live on those hydrocarbons. Right. And over time, they're going to need more as their land base goes away. Therefore, the Arctic is crucial to them.
Yeah, and also just from a transport perspective, when I look at the globe, it seems like if those oceans opened up, it would be a relatively fast way to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Oh, exactly. No, that's the main point of all this is you save weeks and weeks of transit time at sea, making that run from, say, Europe to Asia, going right over the top of the world. And Russia would love to have control over that water.
Yeah, and in talking about this, you say that the U.S. Navy needs more icebreakers. I was surprised to read that we only have apparently one operational icebreaker compared with Russia's dozens of icebreakers. And even China, I think you said, who has no border with the Arctic, has 10 icebreakers. Is that right?
They do. And Denmark, tiny little nation, has 6 icebreakers. You know, we're way behind on this one. We park those icebreakers in the Coast Guard. I'm told that there is a movement to add a couple of significant icebreakers to the Coast Guard budget. Let's hope that's the case.
Well, I've heard stories that Vladimir Putin sort of sees himself as the second coming of Peter the Great, who built Russia into a great naval power. And the current expansion of the Russian Navy seems to bear that out. Talk a little about Russia's capabilities right now and in the near future.
I will, but let's go back 20 years and observe that the Russian Navy of 20 years ago at the end of the Cold War is a big, powerful Navy, roughly the size of the United States, 500 ships. End of the Cold War, the Russians break up that Navy. They put a lot of it in mothballs. They move away from the idea of being a significant maritime power. Vladimir Putin takes office. Over the last 7 years, he's pumped an enormous amount of money into the military in general and the Navy in particular. Russia will add 100 ships to its fleet over the next 3 years, and they are not quite back up to being the size, scope, and scale of the U.S. Navy, but I'd say they're probably 70% as good as our Navy. And in a couple of zones, particularly undersea warfare with submarines, the use of hypersonic high-speed cruise missiles at sea, the use of long-range aviation, they are equal. So they are presenting a real challenge, and they're operating all around the world, much as they did in the Cold War. Russia's Navy is back under Vladimir Putin.
And to counter this, you call for a buildup of the U.S. fleet from the current 275 ships to 350. What do you say to those who say, well, we need smarter, faster, more flexible ships, not necessarily more ships?
We need both. Quantity has a quality all its own. No matter how good a ship is, no matter how offensive it is, no matter how efficient it is, it can only be in one place at one time. And you need 300, and let's keep the numbers round to keep the math easy. Let's call it 360. So divide it by three. So that's 120. Of those 360 ships, 120 are going to be in a shipyard. They need repair and updating. Ships require a lot of maintenance because they operate out in the ocean. Second, 120 are in training, getting ready to go forward. So you need 360, Ben, to make 120 that can be forward deployed, centered around four carrier battle groups, one in Northeast Asia, one in Southeast Asia, one in the Arabian Gulf, and one in the Atlantic that can swing between the Baltic and Black Seas and the Med and the High North. So 360 is the number every serious naval analyst has come up with. Under the Obama administration, we drifted down to 275. They are good ships. They're very capable. But we need 350 to make the numbers work.
Well, before we go, I want to talk a little bit about your time as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. What was that like? With 29 members, is it a little bit like herding cats?
Yeah, it's first of all, it's a wonderful job. You can, you know, any job that starts with the word supreme is a good job to have. The challenge of it is that you have 28 nations who have utterly different culture, history, language, geographic location, demographics, military skill sets, and somehow you have to be the conductor of the band and bring them together to go do significant combat missions. We had to create the NATO force for Afghanistan, for the Balkans, for Syria, for piracy, for cyber security. And so it was the most challenging period of my life to put all those disparate cultures and languages and abilities and capabilities together in a coherent way to take on real world missions. And then lastly, it was an honor to come to work every morning and sit down at the desk that Dwight Eisenhower used as the first Supreme Allied Commander. The history was powerful.
And as part of that job, you dealt a lot with the European countries. I've heard you say that Angela Merkel is the most principled world leader today. What do you admire about her?
I'll give you three things. First of all, she's modest, she's quiet, she's thoughtful, she's smart, she has a PhD. She is a quiet, calm leader, so I admire her personality. Secondly, her value set. She, at great political risk to herself, accepted 1 million refugees into Germany 2 years ago. That will pay off for Germany in the long haul. Many of them will become terrific Germans, just like our immigrants here are terrific Americans. But she took huge political risk to do that. And she did it because she felt it was the right thing to do. They were refugees from a civil war. I admire that kind of value-driven approach. And then thirdly, she's an extremely pragmatic and clever politician. She's about to be elected for a third term as the Chancellor of Germany. She has seen many, many rivals come and go. She's been the Chancellor through Bush, through Obama. She'll outlast Trump in that job, I suspect. she's a clever politician on top of the other two attributes.
And speaking of Trump, you know, he hasn't been the staunchest supporter of NATO. He's vacillated on his support for NATO from the election to now. What could be the fallout of his flip-flopping on NATO?
Well, I went and met with President-elect Trump at his request to discuss being Secretary of State in the Trump administration. I had previously been identified with the Hillary Clinton's campaign and, in fact, had been vetted for VP with Hillary. But Trump asked me down, and so I went. And we had a fairly good conversation. And at that time, despite having bashed NATO thoroughly throughout the entire election, he told me that he could see the good in NATO and that he would support NATO. Now we're sort of 6 months after that, and I think that's largely come true. I have to say he spent a lot of time denigrating NATO, but he went to the NATO summit. It wasn't perfect, but he's pushing them to spend more. But he's also showing a reasonable level of support personally. And General Mattis is doing a very good job of reassuring our allies. So I think even under a Trump administration, the future of NATO is bright. And I think the president has begun to understand the return on investment. It's so much better to have allies. I'll close by saying Winston Churchill said somewhere that the only thing worse than fighting a war with allies alongside you is fighting one without allies. In other words, it's frustrating to have allies. They don't always do exactly what you want, but something beats nothing.
Before we go, you say that all the days that you spent on the deep ocean, out of sight of land, all totaled, they add up to nearly 11 years. Now that you're retired from the Navy and at Tufts University, has it been a bit of a bittersweet adjustment to get used to being away from the ocean?
It has. And in some ways, sea power, which is a lot of different things, a book about what it's like to sail the ocean and what the history of the oceans are and the current geopolitics that we just discussed. But the other thing sea power is was a therapeutic act for this aging admiral, an opportunity to sum up 37 years in the Navy and really close the chapter. And it has been bittersweet. I miss the ocean. I still get to see from time to time, but not like I did. And I miss having an office with that kind of a view.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Again, the book is called Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Admiral Stavridis, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Ben, it's been my pleasure.
Thanks again to Admiral James Stavridis for joining me. Order his new book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans on Amazon. Or download the audio version for free with a special trial offer from Audible at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. And follow him on Twitter at @StavridisJ. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.